So I decided to title today's sermon, Something to Cheer You Up. Retailers might need cheering up, losing an entire weekend of pre-Christmas shopping. Those of us who have an affection for even a semblance of the traditional Thanksgiving might need cheering up after worried retailers apportioned all or part of the holiday so eager shoppers could precede Black Friday with what I'll call Cranberry Thursday. And folks of all political and economic positions might need cheering up because wherever we are on the political continuum, right, left, or center, the current state of politics in America offers little comfort to anyone. Some of you could rightly wonder if any rational mind would see discussing the Holocaust as conducive to cheerfulness. First, I've never claimed to have a rational mind, a proposition I'm sure Vicky would support wholeheartedly. Second, some of us have our own unique way of perceiving events. And this is something that I think we just need to emphasize over and over again, and that is our perceptions of reality are ours, but they might not correspond to another person's. Sometimes that works well and sometimes not so well. For example, Jim calls Mike. Mike, I'm calling you from the freeway on my new cell phone. Mike replies, be careful, Jim. They just said on the radio that there's a nut driving the wrong way on the freeway. One nut? Hell, there are hundreds of them. Well, in truth, in terms of our perceptions, this is not at all a sermon about the Holocaust, but rather about the rescue of Samuel Oliner that set in motion an amazing series of research events. Furthermore, it's about how rescuers all over the world, past and present, challenge many contemporary beliefs about human nature. And so the question that we have is, why do they do it? Why do they risk everything, their safety, their lives, even their families, to strangers? They harbor those who are looked upon as the dregs of society. They are willing to assist Jews at a time where there is no sympathy for Jewish people. They leap into rivers to pull drowning strangers from cars being sucked to the bottom. They run into the devastated Twin Towers to offer safety on 9/11. For a long time, the question wasn't even asked. Some individuals were honored as heroes and saints, but it was as if they weren't really human. They just occupied this very special category, completely different from the rest of us. And the rest of us, I guess we're supposed to be the typical philosophical, economic, psychological view. Self-interest, rational choice, the struggle for survival, these were our characteristics. Auguste Comte, the father of sociology, coined the term altruism in the mid-19th century. But unselfish behavior on behalf of another sort of disappeared for a while. And now, quite the contrary, it is a research growth area in the social sciences. Once it was the elephant in the halls of Ivy, because our contemporary prevailing explanations couldn't quite account for why so many people would risk so much. Altruistic behavior calls into question a lot of our assumptions about what it means to be a human being. And answering these questions now has become more and more important to us. And that's where I say we can become cheered up a bit, because the information about altruism is certainly encouraging. Here's how it started. Sam Oliner, sociologist, taught the evils of Nazis and anti-Semitism. He had that personal experience, remember. He studied and taught the evils of racism, homophobia, and of other oppressions. He would begin one of the first courses in the nation on genocide with Native American Studies professor Jack Norton, who applied the concept of the attempted eradication of Native peoples in Northern California to this view. But in the early 1980s, something happened while Olliner was teaching his Holocaust studies course. After one of the sessions of the term, a young woman came to him in tears. She was German, married to an American student. She had to drop the course, she told him, because it was too painful to hear, quote, what my people did to your people, end quote. I was moved by this, Olliner recalled. First of all, she had nothing to do with it. She was innocent. But her pain got me thinking, what else can we teach beside horrors and murder and torture? What else can we learn? And that's when he thought about the family that had been that significant role in saving his life. They didn't have to do it, and truthfully, they did expose themselves to the possibility of immediate execution. So why? It's not such an easy question to answer given the thrust of our philosophical assumptions. And our philosophical assumptions have been, generally speaking, that we are understandably self-interested. We promote the survival of our own genetic material. So it's confusing. And we're not helped by folks like Ayn Rand, who wrote, "What is the moral code of altruism? The basic principle of altruism is that we have no right to exist for our own sake, that service to others is the only justification of our existence, and that self-sacrifice is our highest moral duty. Do not confuse altruism with kindness, goodwill, or respect for the rights of others," she wrote. "The irreducible primary of altruism, the basic absolute, is self-sacrifice, which means self-immolation, self-abnegation, self-denial, self-destruction, which means the self as a standard of evil and the selfless as a standard of good. Do not hide behind such superficialities as whether you should or should not give a dime to a beggar. That is not the issue. The issue is whether you do or do not have the right to exist without giving him that dime. The issue is whether you must keep buying your life, dime by dime, from any beggar who might choose to approach you. The issue is whether the need of others is the first mortgage on your life and the moral purpose of your existence. The issue is whether we are to be regarded as a sacrificial animal." Groucho Marx, that great philosopher, once said, "These are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others." Now, whatever we may feel about Ayn Rand, she stuck by her principles consistently. And we've lived to see many of those principles make their appearance in aspects of contemporary libertarian thought, which is so ironic because during her lifetime, Ayn Rand spent a fair amount of time saying absolutely vicious things about libertarians. But her thought has also been influential in the lives of folks like Alan Greenspan and Paul Ryan. I do understand the appeal of Ayn Rand's ideas. They give us permission and encouragement to be both selfish and self-righteous, a very potent combo. And of course, the beggar in her example is a complete abstraction, an idea rather than a person. And when we can turn others into stereotypes, depersonalize them, like people on welfare or illegals or takers, not makers, we are allowed to not care about others or the other. So with Hanukkah ending this year, this Thursday on December 5, here's a little illustration about depersonalization. Abe and his friend Saul are out for a walk. They pass a Catholic church with a sign out front that reads, $100 to anyone who converts. Saul decides to go inside and see what it's all about. Abe waits outside. Hours go by, and finally Saul emerges. "So," says Abe, "what happened?" "I converted," said Saul. "No kidding. Did you get the $100? Is that all you people think about?" So one of the ironies of Jewish history, following centuries of massacre, attempts at genocide, free-floating anti-Semitism, is the concept of mitzvah as essential to the tradition. Mitzvah is M-I-T-Z-V-A-H, and the plural is mitzvahs. It's a commandment. It's a meritorious act, one that expresses God's will. It is a good work. But here's the little fly in the ointment. Even though it's a commandment, even though it's a duty and an obligation, it has no significance unless it is carried out with a joyful heart. In other words, if you do a mitzvah only because you have an ulterior motive in mind, like, prospering in some way or being in God's good graces, then the value of the act is nil. You have to do it because it is significant to you, because it fills your life with joy. It's an interesting concept and a challenging concept, but an important concept. Mitzvah. A mitzvah is an act of altruism, but it doesn't have to be heroic. It could be very simple and very basic. You could carry out acts of mitzvah every day of the week. And they can be as simple as speaking pleasantly to a very beleaguered retail worker, or honestly to caring about somebody in your office, somebody who needs a little bit of a boost and support. Acts of altruism, performing mitzvahs, are undertaken not out of pity, but out of empathy. We see in the beggar not only someone for whom we feel sorrow, but someone for whom we feel, period. Ayn Rand's beggar could, in fact, be our brother, our sister, our mother, our father, or ourselves. They have a face, a brain, a heart, and a story. Just as the Jews rescued from the Holocaust were identified by their rescuers as fellow beings, brothers and sisters, to use the metaphor of traditional religious language. I think it's important to say this because pity alone is also not significant enough, because pity can distance us from the person that we feel pity for. It is empathy. It is that feeling for another person, not because they are different from us, but because we are, after all, alike. It happened in thousands of times, from diplomats to businessmen such as Oskar Schindler to peasant families who helped little Sam Olliner. People care and risk their lives for other people. And these people are empathic, they feel for others, and they internalize an ethic of caring and social responsibility. Ecumenically, we learn that we are all the children of God, and we are all worthy of love and protection and dignity. So how do we help achieve altruism? We recognize that we can't build bonds among people by intellect alone. Institutions have to appeal not only to the intellect, but to our emotions. Compassion and empathy are most effectively taught through stories, which is why fiction can be so powerful and why we turn to it over and over again. Because through the best of fiction, people on the page come to life for us in a way that they might not, honestly, in our day-to-day lives. We identify with characters, we suffer with them, we struggle with them, and we hope for them. And then in addition, we have to do more than preach or talk about caring. We have to embody it, we have to do it, we have to act upon it, we have to truly give it life. Olliner, in his book, Do Unto Others, quotes Albert Einstein, and Einstein said this: "A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal decisions and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole nature in its beauty. After quoting that, Alliner comes back with his own personal response. I have seen and experienced a world of cruelty and uncaring. I also know that helping in hundreds of different ways is psychologically and physically beneficial to the helper. One can feel well by doing good. As for myself, I have tried to live a caring life and to be helpful to others. Perhaps my own personal losses have turned me in the direction of studying the nature of goodness. For that dark beginning made me yearn for light, and goodness is indeed the light of the world. If you're interested, Vicki has copies of an article that she just read about the very many benefits that accrue to us when we engage in altruistic behavior. And you can see her at her table in the social hall. But I will just return to that great work of art, which I mentioned last week and will mention again, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. When Charlie Bucket proves himself worthy of Willy's trust, Gene Wilder as Willy utters a line I've always remembered and enjoyed. So shines a good deed in a weary world. The correct quote, fully, from The Merchant of Venice, Act 5, Scene 1, is spoken by Portia. That light we see is burning in my hall. How far that little candle throws its beams. So shines a good deed in a weary world. We all know from another quotation, rather simple, better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Perhaps that rather simple thought is more important than we realize. So shines a good deed in a weary world. And whenever we can, we light that candle.